This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Let me ask you something. What do you expect out of this program today? And if you don't get it, would you stop listening? Sell us off, if you will. The economic dangers of the expectations game coming up on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 22nd of July. Today, Wednesday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We are hip deep in that four times a year Wall Street ritual that is most easily summarized as earnings season. Publicly traded companies announce how much money they made or lost in the previous 3 months, and usually why they made or lost it. I say usually because there is a dance that happens here in earnings season. In making their profit announcements, CEOs try to paint things in as good a light as possible, while Wall Street analysts and business journalists, I'm obliged to add, try to parse things as finely as they possibly can. And often the expectations of Wall Street and the realities of a company's earnings don't match up. Case in point, a little company you might have heard of called Apple. CEO Tim Cook said yesterday they made a boatload of money in the third quarter without actually using the word boatload, I should say. Revenues were up by 30%. Cook called it an amazing quarter. For him, perhaps. Not so much, though, for investors who'd been expecting Apple to sell more iPhones than it did. Missing those expectations sent Apple shares down more than 4.5% today. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is here to school us in the dangers of high expectations.
What's the worst thing your parents can say to you?
Trace, I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
I even know my mom's pretending here, and that still guts me. And you know what? Disappointment can gut stock prices, too.
Companies would like to exceed the expectations. It looks much better to do that rather than disappoint.
Len Rosenthal, a finance professor at Bentley University, says companies will issue guidance trying to manage investors' expectations. Some companies might even try to game expectations, setting them intentionally low so they can exceed them.
Oh, yeah, that's not a new thing. It's been going on for a long, long time. Yeah, I think it's kind of silly in some ways, but that's the way the game is played.
Rosenthal thinks there's too much emphasis on quarterly numbers, that the markets often overreact. But these expectations, they come from either published reports from analysts, like Gene Munster, he's with Piper Jaffray, or from investors themselves, in the form of what Munster calls a whisper number.
Whisper numbers are the collective expectation from investors who own a stock about a specific metric. In Apple's case, how many iPhones they're going to sell in a quarter.
It's this murky thing. You can find out the whisper number by polling a bunch of investors. Miss expectations, the stock may go down. Exceed them, and the stock may rise. But beat that whisper number too often, investors may come to expect too much. Munster thinks Apple may have been the victim of its own success over the last decade.
The success has created this underlying belief from investors that they can always do a little bit better.
And with expectations that high, Munster says disappointment is kind of inevitable. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The very last thing we want to do is to disappoint you, which is why we've got an explainer on our website about how investors value companies, of which earnings and expectations thereof are just a part. You can find our latest whiteboard videos at our website. It's marketplace.org. All right, moving on. You come to California, you can expect to pay more for gas. That's just the way it is out here, partly because of the way our gasoline market is set up. But I'm not sure anybody expected to be paying this much more. According to Consumer Watchdog, from February to June, California drivers have shelled out $4.5 billion more for their gasoline than other U.S. drivers have. Here in L.A., we're at about $4.25 a gallon. What's up with that is a fair question, as is what's going on with oil refineries in California who are reporting profits almost double what they normally take in per gallon of gasoline. From the land of much cheaper gas, that'd be Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Dubin reports.
Willie Hudgens drives a 2006 Ford Expedition stretch limo. Earlier today, he pulled into a mobile station in Birmingham to get gas.
So what are you paying per gallon right now?
I think we're at $2.39, which is great.
So you remember when gas prices were way higher than they are now. So $2.39 for you right now is like what?
Oh, it's like, man, pennies on a dollar.
Then there's California, where Severin Bornstein is with the Energy Institute at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. The national average for gasoline is $2.74 a gallon.
Typically, California prices should be about 40 cents above the national average.
In Los Angeles, people are paying $1.50 more a gallon. Part of that is because California requires a cleaner burning fuel.
And as a result, we can't trade gasoline with other parts of the country. We need this special blend.
He also says when there's a hiccup in the production of that special blend, like the ExxonMobil refinery explosion in February, there's no quick way to relieve a shortage. That's when you get price spikes. But Bornstein says usually those fizzle out within a month or so. Not this time.
It has definitely raised concerns that this isn't just natural shortages.
One explanation, the California Energy Commission says refineries are making more than twice the profit per gallon than they made a year ago. Finally, when other states have shortages, they bring gasoline in through pipelines. But California doesn't have pipelines, so the gas comes by barge or tanker. And that costs more. Ed Herz is an energy economist at the University of Houston. He has a message for California residents.
You guys are screwed. Those are highly technical industrial terms. You're screwed in California.
Herz says California's refineries can't meet consumer demand. And when you combine that with lacking infrastructure, you're going to pay for it. Just like consumers did in New England this past winter. There, Herz says, there were no pipelines to bring in enough natural gas to meet electricity demands. I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
Oil today, by the way, down under $50 a barrel at the close in New York. Down two were the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, was signed into law 25 years ago this coming Sunday. Think for just a second about the ways this economy has changed in the past 25 years, and you'll surely get where we are going with this next story. Developers and programmers are testing some new tech ideas with the disabled community in mind, as Lauren Silverman reports from KERA in Dallas.
Sometimes Chad Habel will go to a restaurant with friends, only to find himself physically cut off from his company.
You're looking, you know, under the table at everybody else. You can't see above the table.
Habel is in a wheelchair. He's also a businessman with an eye for health and technology ideas.
I could see a huge value for having an app or something that could translate saying, hey, here are the three cafes you can go to. Here are the ones you need to stay away from because there's cobblestone or the bathroom doors are only 12 inches wide or the elevators you won't fit in.
Many of the high-tech gadgets and apps created today aren't designed for people with different abilities. Just think about how Google Maps doesn't tell you whether the sidewalks are wheelchair accessible, or how you still need to use your hands to make a drawing on your tablet.
There is definitely a niche, and there's definitely a need for enhancements that could help everyday issues that we face.
Which is exactly why student Oluwatosin Oluwadari is spending his days in a lab at UT Arlington, surrounded by loose cables and pieces of robotics.
Right now it's in the early stage, it's more like a prototype we have.
Oluwadari and his partner are showing me how their device for the visually impaired works.
Can I stand in front of it and it will look at me?
Yes.
It's called ICU, and it describes characteristics of people standing in front of you.
All I need is an image of you.
Oluwadari puts on a pair of glasses with a camera attached and snaps my photo.
The description of the person in front of you is as follow.
Then it describes me.
Person 1 is wearing an orange dominant shirt, has a light skin complexion. She is a female adult.
Well, that is just
That's
what
pretty
it
much
does.
How I'd describe myself. So far, the device right analyzes now, age, gender, skin, and shirt color. Oluwadari admits that some of the features it's programmed to report may be sensitive, like skin color or age. But guidance from people living with disabilities is helping shape the technology. Sean Horn likes that.
Unless you talk to the people that you're trying to help, you're not going to know, even with your best intentions, how to help.
Horn is a writer in Manhattan. She also has cerebral palsy. She's working with developers like the ICU creators in a national competition called the Connectability Challenge. Whoever comes up with the best tech to empower folks with disabilities wins $100,000. The project is sponsored by AT&T and New York University. Since Horn has poor balance and muscle control, she's hoping to see some cool hands-free technology.
You know, the fact that I walk around the world with shiny blue ski poles means that my hands are occupied.
One device in the competition she likes is called Palette. It transforms your tongue into a mouse that can control anything from a wheelchair to a light setting. Another technology called Drum Pants gives a voice to people with difficulty speaking. They just have to tap sensors on their pants or shirt that have pre-programmed phrases.
The fact that we can collaborate and create things that not only work in theory, but actually have an impact on the future of someone's life, this kind of technology can be life-changing.
The winner of the Connectability Challenge will be chosen this Sunday on the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Loath though we are to mention school in the middle of what is supposed to be a couple of months off for 6 to 18-year-olds in this country, the fact is that summertime is often not that good for actual learning. A lot of kids, it turns out, low-income kids to be precise, often lose a whole lot of knowledge between June and September. On the theory that nobody really wants to grind out summer school as a way to keep up, while he was in college, a guy by the name of Kareem Abulnaga founded a company, it's called Practice Makes Perfect, that's supposed to help those low-income students retain their hard-won smarts. Kareem, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So there you are. You're, what, a junior, senior in college, and you notice this thing called the summer achievement gap. And then what do you do?
Yeah, I was 18, actually, my sophomore year.
Wow.
Got a crazy idea after all this research and really brought together a group of friends to try and pay it forward.
Well, explain to me a little bit how you do that, because, you know, the idea that socioeconomically challenged kids lose a lot of ground in the summertime isn't new. People have tried it. Tell me what you did that was different.
I think it started with the research, and the research resonated a lot more for me. I was raised by a single mother on government aid and went through some of New York City's most struggling public schools and really just started to think about what the different interventions would have been that would have made my life and so many of my peers' lives so much easier. We started having a few meetings and started applying for different grants and awards to get a project funded.
Let me back you up for a minute. What did you do during summer times when you were a kid?
I mean, I vaguely remember being having to go to summer school 1 year, but then every summer after that, I stayed home. I watched TV. There were a few summers where I shadowed my father while he was working in a store, but to the extent that I did anything productive, not really.
So let's walk me through one of your programs. You identify a school or a child or however you do it, and then how does it work in practice?
Yep. So we find a low-income either public, charter, or Catholic school. We pitch them on the idea of identifying a group of their kids. There's a service fee involved, about $50,000. It comes out to about $1,000 a kid. And then we actually have a teacher for every two classes.
First of all, who pays that $50,000 or $1,000 per child?
So right now, the schools have been going out of budget. They've been reallocating their summer school funding. And so actually for the first time this year, we're replacing mandated summer school programs in New York City with our innovative enrichment model.
Part of the model is this, having near peers teach the younger group, right? So the middle schoolers and the elementary schoolers and all that. How does that work out in practice? Because I know a couple of middle schoolers, and I don't know if I would trust them to teach anybody younger.
When I pitched the idea of having a sixth grader mentor a second grader, people thought we were crazy. And I can tell you that in practice, it works wonders. I mean, it's amazing. Education still is very much a relationship-based business. The number one reason why kids show up to our programs every single summer is because of the relationship they build with their mentors.
I hate to get all establishment on you here, but it's all about measuring output now, right? Measuring achievement and standardized tests and all that stuff. So how do you know that what you are doing works?
I mean, we give our kids a pretest and a post-test. And every single year to date so far, we've eliminated the summer learning loss for 100% of our participants, which means they've at least broken even during a time period where they're supposed to regress. And in many cases, have actually made gains on average of 5% in reading and 7% in math, which is almost, instead of going back to school 3 months behind, they're now going back to school a month ahead.
Kareem Abulnaga, he is the founder and CEO of Practice Makes Perfect. Kareem, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up,
I think executives are working a little bit harder to make the music then play into the film a little bit better.
Movies and their music, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 0.3% today, about 68 points, closed at 17,851. The NASDAQ erased 0.7%, 36 points, finished at 5,171. The S&P 500 reversed 0.25%, 5 points. 2114. First to the earnings palooza. Microsoft continued to be punished after yesterday's quarterly report. Shares down nearly 4%. Cirrus Logic, which is a chip supplier for Apple, was down 5% before the bell, but a solid quarterly report afterward. Shares recovered much of that loss. Investors put the lid on Tupperware after it reported weak earnings. Stock down more than 8% today. McDonald's is going to report in the morning. In the meanwhile, though, reports that breakfast would become an all-day thing put a shine on the Golden Arches. Shares up 0.25% because really, who doesn't love an Egg McMuffin in the afternoon? Or maybe that's just me. I don't know. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House subcommittee on health and technology holds a hearing titled Modern Tools in a Modern World, How App Technology is Benefiting Small Businesses. I mentioned this was happening earlier in the week. It's actually scheduled to take place tomorrow. Amazon is scheduled to announce quarterly earnings. And the Lumberjack World Championships get underway in Hayward, Wisconsin. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Caitlyn Jenner's new show debuts on E! This Sunday. That's E! Exclamation point, the entertainment television channel. To say there is a lot of interest in Jenner right now would be an understatement. It would also be a business opportunity for the E! Network. Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports.
Not so long ago, E! Entertainment TV was about getting your fix of celebrity news. But that wasn't going so well as people got more and more of their fix online. Then in 2007, the Kardashians debuted their reality show.
I'm Kris Jenner, because I'm the mom. I'm the mom and Kim's manager.
So the Kardashians sort of came at a very opportune time for E!
That's Michael O'Connell, TV writer for The Hollywood Reporter.
They were in desperate need to sort of take another look at what their bread and butter was going to be.
In the years since, the Kardashians brand has been practically one with the network. There have been spin-off shows and, for a while, a fairly loyal audience. About 4 years ago, E! Averaged 650,000 primetime viewers. But then he went down to 560,000, and last season, 540,000. The numbers are headed in the wrong direction.
E!'s problem is what a lot of cable networks face.
And that's splintered audiences, says Joe Adelian, West Coast editor of New York Magazine's Vulture.com. Adelian says what TV networks want is water cooler fodder, which is why E! Is now banking on Caitlyn Jenner's new show, I Am Kate.
You are normal.
Put it this way. I'm the new normal.
I Am Kate could potentially be a game changer for E!.
Because, says Adelian, Caitlyn Jenner is the subject of intense interest. Her interview on ABC's 2020 reached 17 million viewers, numbers 2020 hadn't seen in 15 years. Adelian says those kinds of ratings mean money.
I've no doubt that E!, especially after the Diane Sawyer interview came out and did so well, was able to go back to advertisers and say, I think you want to be here.
The big question, says Adelian, is whether Jenner's show will retain audiences after the initial curiosity wears off. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Sometimes a movie is just a movie. Nice pictures, good story, and you're done. Sometimes, though, a movie lives on through its music. Case in contemporary point, Fast and Furious 7, which has been gone from theaters for a while now, but the soundtrack for which has been dominating the music charts for months. It's actually part of a bigger soundtrack trend. This is the fourth soundtrack to have topped the charts in the past year. Garrick Kennedy writes on music for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
So value judgment right here up front, the Furious 7 soundtrack. Good, not good, worth it, not worth it. You're grimacing.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting you to ask me if I liked it. You know, those movies, they're just not my thing.
Yeah.
So I don't always naturally attach myself to the music.
Right.
Even though I thought it was a really good soundtrack,
I did. Well, so let's talk about this for a second. How do you separate soundtrack from movie? Because that's part of what's going on in this whole thing.
I think the music has a really big part of it. Take for instance 50 Shades of Grey.
Not the greatest movie.
Okay. Decent enough book. Soundtrack super hot, and I think we saw what just happened with really successful music and how you build that into the film. So The Weeknd has his major record right now, earned it, and it's from the movie. It's not something that I don't think everybody who are Weeknd fans identify the 50 Shades of Grey, but everybody that saw 50 Shades of Grey, they know this song. So this song is killing pop radio.
That is higher level culture math right there. You know? I mean, it kind of really is, because in a way you're dissociating the two.
Right.
And yet at the same time, it all kind of comes together at the
end. It all comes together. But then you see something like Furious 7, and that's going to have a soundtrack that's going to be a little bit more hip hop. What really helped that soundtrack, though, was the Wiz Khalifa track See You Again, which is a tribute to, you know, Paul Walker, who unfortunately passed for the movie.
It's been a long day without you, my friend.
That song was so hot, and it sort of was a hit in its own self just because of the nature of what the song is about. So then that translated right over to the soundtrack.
Oh, I'll tell you all about it when I see you again.
There's another thing that's happening, not with the soundtrack really, but related to the movie, and that's Tyrese. And then he's got his own album now, Black Rose, which is doing really well. And he's sort of getting double credit for having been in the movie and then doing his own thing as well.
Number one album for him. And, you know, what's really interesting, I don't know if you saw this, but how he promoted that album is something you haven't seen. He really did grassroots. I mean, this man was on subways and he was on buses and he was peddling it, you know, really old school stuff. You know, because R&B isn't something that necessarily sells the way that hip hop or pop does. So it's harder for those artists to, you know, get themselves out there because they don't have as many platforms as these other genres do. So to see that this guy, he had a hot movie this summer and now he's like, you know, buy the record.
Right.
I know why you left me. But most of his fans are not going to be Furious 7 fans, you know?
Okay, so no, wait, you have to explain that to me, because
he's an R&B heartthrob, right. So that is, you know, females. And even though Furious 7 is like a really great date movie, I don't see a lot of R&B fans who would listen to Tyrese and have supported Tyrese all these years to be like, let's go see Furious 7. Right, now, there's a huge subsect of that fan base who supports him, so they go see all these movies and they probably bought the album. But they were probably more excited about the fact that this is the first Tyrese album in a couple of years.
Huh. Do you think that studio executives, when they're putting together the soundtracks, how much attention do they devote to, let's see if we can get some bump from the movie because of the soundtrack? You got to figure it's in their wheelhouse somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you see executives do some really cool things. I mean, look at what Hunger Games did with their last soundtrack, and they had Lorde curated.
Welcome to your life.
I thought that was a really brilliant idea because Lorde speaks to a younger generation.
My 12-year-old knew that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also, the great thing about that is Lorde is somebody who is a true artist. So it's not like, hey, let's just put together all these different like songs that could be huge records. Like, it was another cohesive soundtrack. And I think that's also why that did well, too. And you got to discover new artists on that project. You got to see collaborations you wouldn't have normally thought of. It was a really cool soundtrack.
Everybody wants to lose.
The whole thing, though, that you keep saying about cohesive soundtrack, which I get in principle, sort of goes against the grain of what music's been the last, I don't know, 8-10 years, where you can buy one for 99 cents, make a playlist, and do all this stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, that brings you back to, if we're keeping it strictly on soundtracks, that brings you back to what was happening in the 90s, where it was always about the whole body. It was always the entire soundtrack is what, you know, you went out and bought. Just, you might not even seen the movie, especially with a lot of, you know, the 90s comedies, but the soundtrack was so solid. I mean, if you think a lot of the big records that came out, you know, in the 90s, you think of Aaliyah, you know, Brandy, all these people had these really huge soundtrack numbers, but you don't always know what the movie was. Now, I think executives are working a little bit harder to make the music then play into the film a little bit better.
Gary Kennedy writes on music for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks so much. This was so much fun.
This final note on the way out today, in which Uber wins a big one. The mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, has been going after the pioneering sharing economy company in a very public way the past couple of weeks, saying he wanted to limit the number of Ubers on city streets. As of today, the mayor has blinked. The city is now going to, quote, study the effect of for-hire cars on, one would imagine, the taxicab industry in New York. Moral of the story? You can indeed fight City Hall. On the way out, here you go. The Dow Industrials off a 3% today, about 68 points. The NASDAQ down 0.7%, 36 points. The S&P 500 gave back 0.25%, 5 points. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. I'm Kyle Risdon. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.